and I represent the appellant, Jeremy Hansen. My daughter Elizabeth is here with me today as well. The resolution of this case is governed by the legislature's use of the words rescind and rescission in enacting Section 35109. That statute requires the Motor Vehicle Department, upon request, to recalculate the habitual traffic offender status of persons convicted of operating after suspension. The statute says if the recalculation demonstrates that the person is not a habitual traffic offender, the department shall rescind the order declaring the applicant a habitual traffic offender. The statute goes on to require the department to issue an order of rescission. The legislature is presumed to know the meaning of the words it uses in enacting statutes, and while this statute itself does not define the words rescind or rescission, those words have common and approved usage. Rescind means to abrogate or annul. That is the dictionary definition, and it's the definition that we all learned in our law school classes on contracts and remedies. When the legislature chose the word rescind, it expressed that a person who applies for and receives a recalculation will be put back in the position as if he or she had never been designated a habitual traffic offender.
Counsel, let me ask you then, in this case, there's some retroactivity here because, as I recall, your client pled no contest, and then there was a recalculation. Is there a retroactive, some statute that would give some effect to the retroactivity of the recension by the Department of Motor Vehicles?
The sequence of events in this case is that Mr. Hansen was declared a habitual traffic offender in December of 1996. In October of 1998, he received a ticket for operating after revocation. On February 3rd, 1999, after he had made an application and after the Motor Vehicle Department had recalculated his status, they rescinded his status as a habitual traffic offender. And on May 9, 1999, he was convicted and sentenced as if he were a habitual traffic offender. It's my position, Your Honor, that because the legislature uses the word rescind in Section 35109, that when Mr. Hansen applied for and received the order of rescission, it's as if he never were a habitual traffic offender.
Mr. Connell, why shouldn't we look at the date of the violation? That apparently was October of 98. Why shouldn't that be the focus? And at that time, he was HTO status. Is that not correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Isn't that the significant time, not the time of sentencing?
It's my contention that because the penalty that was imposed on Mr. Hansen in this case was because of his status as a habitual traffic offender, and because the legislature, in enacting 35109, chose to use the words rescind and rescission, that the plain meaning of those words is that his status was annulled and abrogated and should be treated as, and he should be treated as if he never were a habitual traffic offender.
And what would the penalty have been for him if he was not HTO?
A forfeiture of up to $2,500.
No time in jail.
No time in jail, and that's the crucial part. In this case, Mr. Hansen received a fine, and in addition, he received a sentence of 20 days.
But how do you get there? I know where you want to get. You just stated it. But how do you get there? Because our law on subject matter jurisdiction is pretty well settled that so long as if a complaint alleges a criminal offense, there's subject matter jurisdiction. And it seems to me another hurdle is the fact that you pled guilty or your client pled no contest. So I can see where you want to get, but how do you get there?
Well, the second question that's been briefed in this case and is the question of did Mr. Hansen waive his right to make the objection he makes today by entering a no-contest plea? And in my post-conviction motions on Mr. Hansen's behalf, I contend, and I contend today, that this is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. That criminal subject matter jurisdiction goes to 3 points. One, the power to inquire into the charged crime. Two, the power to apply applicable law. And three, and what I think applies in this case, the power to declare punishment. I think that the question of subject matter jurisdiction is more than just an examination of the criminal complaint. It requires a determination that the penalty imposed by the court is one that's authorized by law. I contend, for instance, that a defendant could not stipulate to a 10-year prison sentence and waive his right to object when the maximum applicable penalty was 5 years. Courts...
And that would be a matter of subject matter jurisdiction?
I think so. I think it involves the power of the court to apply a penalty.
Do you have authority for that subject matter jurisdiction embraces the power of the court for a penalty?
Well, I do. Not exactly on point, but in the briefs of both parties submitted to the court in this matter, is cited a Court of Appeals case, State versus Andrews. In Andrews, the defendant had entered a guilty or no contest plea to a charge of delivery of a controlled substance within 1,000 feet of a school. And that, of course, involved a penalty enhancer, and he received the penalty enhancement in his sentence. The Court of Appeals indicated that on post, in response to a post-conviction motion, that if he could establish, and he did, that the penalty enhancer could not apply to the facts of the case, in that case because the building that the state alleged was a school didn't fit the statutory definition, that that he could raise that objection despite his no contest plea to the charge. And what the court in that case said was one aspect of criminal subject matter jurisdiction is the power to declare punishment. And in Andrews, the court held that the court lacked the power to impose the penalty enhancer in that case because there was no factual basis for it. So it's my position that case stands for the proposition that the power to impose punishment is one part of the analysis of subject matter jurisdiction that the court must make.
Counsel, on page 18 of your brief, you cite another case, and that is a case from the Court of Appeals of Florida. I didn't read that case, so I'm just reading the excerpt that you cite in your brief. From the excerpt, it appears that it's directly on point. When I say excerpt, I mean, you know, 8 or 9 lines, so I don't know if it's directly on point. But it focuses not on subject matter jurisdiction, but on an illegal sentence. And you make argument on page 19, or you reference illegal sentence on page 19. Is this a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, or is this a matter of illegal sentence, or is it both?
It's both, and I think they're related. I think that when we talk about the jurisdiction of the subject matter involves the authority of the court to impose a punishment. And when a court imposes a punishment in excess of that provided by law, it exceeds its subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, in that regard, Counsel, does Section 973.13 have any application here? That pertains to excessive sentences, errors cured, and says that in any case where the court imposes a maximum penalty in excess of that which is authorized by law, such excess shall be void and the sentence shall be valid only to the extent of the maximum term authorized by statute.
I believe that that would apply to this case. But I have to persuade a court that I'm correct, obviously, for that sentence to be corrected.
I mean, I just pull out copies of the bench book, and I look at pages dealing with just what Justice Sykes is suggesting, modification. It's under the heading of modification of sentence hyphen resentencing. And I'm referring to CR 36-1, which indicates the court has a power to modify or correct sentences. And sub 2 says, sentencing errors subject to correction include factual clerical errors, illegal sentences, sentences in excess of lawful minimums, sentences based on impermissible factors and failure to pay restitution, which isn't a pretty good. And that seems to me to be what is being advanced on pages, in part on pages 18 and 19, but I'm not sure. I could be wrong. I'm not sure I have to go through a subject matter jurisdiction analysis to do that. I'm just not sure.
Well, I, in answer to your first question, I said both apply, and I think that the bench book is based primarily on a case that I didn't cite, but I can cite to you State versus Hayes, an old case where the Supreme Court established the principle that a defendant should not be precluded from challenging an illegal sentence regardless of how the court came to impose the sentence. And that in that case, the court was dealing specifically with the request for modification, but I think that it applies in this case as well. It's my position that the court exceeded its authority in imposing the jail sentence in this case.
Counsel, a number of years back, the legislature changed a lot of criminal statutes, made some more serious, made some less serious. So are you saying, let's assume that John Smith is convicted of battery with a weapon, take your pick, and at the time he commits the crime, it's a felony. Between the time that he commits the crime and the time that he enters his plea, the legislature went through this process, and that crime was now a misdemeanor. Are you saying that John Smith can only be convicted of a misdemeanor?
There is a case right on point, and it's cited in the briefs, Truesdale, which was the case where back in the early 70s, they made possession of marijuana. They reduced it from a felony to a misdemeanor, and Truesdale was caught in between. In other words, he committed the offense when it was a felony and was sentenced when it was a misdemeanor. And in that case, the court held that he could be sentenced as a felon for that offense. And the court cited a statute that we have in Wisconsin on statutory construction, Section 990.04. That statute says that when statutes are repealed or amended, that repeal does not defeat criminal liability. But it contains an exception. Unless expressly remitted, abrogated, or done away with by the repealing statute. And I contend that, and frankly, the common law was, if Mr. Truesdale had been before the court, before the enactment of Section 990.04, the common law was that he'd be sentenced as a misdemeanant in that case. And the Supreme Court said that this statute changes the common law, but it contains the exception. And I contend that exception applies in this case because the legislature chose to use words of art, I believe, rescind, rescission. They have a specific legal meaning. And they mean that Mr. Hansen, in this case, is to be treated as if he never were a habitual traffic offender.
Then, that's a good answer. Now let me take us into this case, these facts, but change one fact. And that is that the legislature enacts the change after his entry of a plea of guilty or no contest. Now, I take it you would say that you should still be here.
I think I could make that argument, although I don't have to make it in this case. And I think the question that's been raised of waiver and subject matter jurisdiction might be different, too. In this case, Mr. Hansen appeared before the court on May 4th, 1999, without the habitual traffic offender label, because it had been rescinded. And when the judge sentenced him on that day, there was, in my view, there was no habitual traffic offender status out there. Now, if the law subsequently changed, an argument could be made, I believe, if the legislature uses words like rescind or rescission,
I know an argument could be made, but would you want to make it? Do you say that if that occurred, it seems to me that when your argument, with your argument that the word rescission puts things back as if it never happened, the time of the legislative act seems to be irrelevant in your argument. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, that is an argument that could be made.
Okay.
And you know, I was thinking last night about this case, and I was thinking about the HTO is a penalty enhancer as applied to this case, and I was thinking about the most commonly used penalty enhancer in Wisconsin, which is the habitual criminal or repeater statutes. And, you know, that law provides for enhanced penalties for previous criminal convictions which remain of record and unreversed. And that's all the law says. And I couldn't find any cases on this subject, but it seems to me that if a previous conviction was reversed by this court, for instance, after a subsequent offense and the issuance of a complaint, would the trial court have jurisdiction to impose the penalty enhancer? I don't think so. And I think that's sort of the analogy that I draw to this case, particularly since both are penalty enhancers, although the criminal conviction would have been reversed by a court. In this case, Mr. Hansen's habitual traffic offender status was rescinded by the department upon the directions of the legislature.
Is HTO status an element of the offense for purposes of the attachment of criminal liability?
I don't believe so. I believe that it is a penalty enhancer. And in this unique situation, unlike the repeater laws and most other penalty enhancers, in this situation, it converts what would otherwise have been a civil forfeiture proceeding to a crime.
Do we treat other penalty enhancements as elements of the offense when we instruct juries, etc.?
No. No.
Does that raise any constitutional questions under our recent United States Supreme Court case?
I don't know what you're talking about, Your Honor.
Well, there was a recent United States, I think that was the point of a question. There was a recent United States Supreme Court case, and I'm sorry I can't give you the name of it, but maybe one of my colleagues could, which indicated that if there was an enhancement and it was an element of the crime, that it would have to be given to the jury, just like all other elements of the crime. On the other hand, Wisconsin statute on prior convictions, which are done at sentencing by bringing in the convictions, it's arguable is not touched by that case. So I think that what the justice was getting at is the applicability of that case to this.
Well, also, some penalty enhancers are given to the jury for purposes of fact-finding. The wall-armed penalty enhancer.
I cited Andrews here, which was within 1,000 feet of a school, and I guess that would be one of the types of penalty enhancers where it is, in fact, an element of the crime.
And so when a judge takes a plea to that crime, there has to be a stipulation to those facts.
There has to be a factual basis. The Lee case that I cited in my brief is a case that holds, it's not a Wisconsin case, but it holds that there has to be a factual basis for a habitual criminal. In that case, Mr. Lee pled no contest to some crime as a habitual criminal and was allowed to challenge that because, in fact, there was no factual basis or one wasn't established or couldn't be established that he was a habitual criminal.
And his plea did not waive that challenge?
That was the ruling of the Florida court, a court of appeals in Florida that
any,
I cited.
Any cases like that here?
Well, I again, I cited Andrews, which is the school case. There's a case, State versus Polehammer, that involved a man who pled guilty to a crime which the statute of limitations had expired. And the court in that case said that the conviction could not stand. Those are the closest cases that I could find.
Mr. Connell, I don't quite understand what was going on in the mind of Mr. Hansen. He applied for a rescission. I think he got the rescission, and then he pled guilty. What's going on here?
I don't know. I don't know why he did that, and that's the best answer that I can give you to this case. Obviously, if I had been representing him at the time, he wouldn't have.
But he was represented by counsel, and he did sign that he agreed that the court may use the criminal complaint as a factual basis. And, you know, this is, I'm talking about the plea questionnaire. And he wrote his initials, and he said, I've given up my right to raise any defense I may have to these charges and to have another court review any non-jurisdictional defects in these proceedings. So on that basis is what I understand is what the Court of Appeals came down and said that he had waived his waiver.
That was the basis of the Court of Appeals decision. Again, it's my contention that it is a jurisdictional defect and that he can raise this question. And frankly, I think Justice Bradley put her finger on it too. I think the courts have the inherent authority and perhaps the obligation to correct any excessive sentence. And in this case, it's our contention that the sentence imposed by Judge Hoffman was in excess of that permitted by law. Thank you. That's all I have.
Are there any further questions? I think Justice Prosser is considering the question, so I'm
okay.
The court is asked to take many cases, probably more than 1,000. We take less than 100. We have this case, and it would seem to me the only reason we took this case, or let's put it this way, we could have avoided this whole case and all this problem if Mr. Hansen had simply acted intelligently. Why shouldn't I think that he's almost mocking the system?
Well, you know, the Attorney General talks about him flaunting his status and so forth. In this case, we're not saying that he shouldn't be convicted. We're not saying that operating after suspension isn't an offense under the law and that Mr. Hansen didn't violate that provision of the Wisconsin statutes. What we're saying is at the time of his conviction, he should not have received the increased penalty that he received for being a habitual traffic offender. And the reason he shouldn't have received that penalty is because the legislature has determined that guys like Jeremy Hansen, whose only traffic violations were for license-type violations operating after suspension, and for violations of failure to pay forfeitures, that those types of guys should not be subject to criminal penalties. Here in Oneida County, they recently built a courthouse. All around the state, they're building county courthouses. And I think when the legislature passed these revisions in the law, they intended to to that our jail cells and prison cells should not be occupied by guys like Jeremy Hansen, guys whose only, and he may be stupid, but his own, whose only violations are not driving, not getting his license when he should. And I think that was the legislative call. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Batasik, did I pronounce your name right? All the Batasiks I know pronounce it differently.
The judge, I understand, pronounces it Batasik.
Right.
And I would suspect he knows, but my family says Batasik nonetheless. May it please the court.
So you're going to have to stand right in front of the microphone and make sure you speak into it, otherwise we cannot hear you.
Thank you. May it please the court. Kathleen Batasik, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin, the plaintiff respondent in this case. This case is about the distinction between void and voidable. Mr. Connell argues that this case is about the meaning of the word rescind in new statute 351.09. It's partly about that, but it's also about what status Mr. Hansen had the date of the violation when he was arrested for operating after revocation on October 31st, 1998. Easy to remember, it was Halloween. And one of the justices, I believe it was Justice Crook, suggested, why isn't the date of the violation the significant date here? And that's pretty much where the state's position is located in this case. In the criminal law, we take a snapshot on a specific date, a specific type of conduct is committed by a person, and specific laws may apply to that conduct. And as a result, based on that conduct, on the date of the violation, a criminal complaint can be filed. If the criminal complaint states a crime known to law that the state can support with evidence and prove all of the elements of that offense, then criminal subject matter, overstating a little bit. If the complaint states an offense known to law, criminal subject matter attaches. If the state can prove all of the elements of that offense, then the specific penalty in place on the date of the violation can be imposed on that defendant. The sentence flows from the conduct on the date of the violation and the laws that can be applied to that violation. I say this case is a distinction between void and voidable for this reason. If Mr. Hansen had used the provisions of the new operating after revocation recalculation law 351.09 and prior to driving on Halloween of 1998 had applied for a recalculation and had been successful in obtaining a rescission of his habitual traffic offender status, then he could not have been charged criminally on Halloween 1998. But because he did not avail himself of the opportunity provided by the legislature when it enacted that statute in August of 1998, August 1st of 1998, then Mr. Hansen had that status of habitual traffic offender subject to one revocation order, which was the HTO order, and six different suspensions. Mr. Hansen argues in his brief. Yes.
I'm still troubled somewhat by the Truesdell case and the question that I asked Mr. Connell. So I'd ask you to respond to it also.
Sure.
What if Mr. Hansen, instead of being charged, for a license conviction, was charged at a with possession of marijuana at the time that it was a felony? And between the time he was charged and the time he pled guilty, the legislature changed that to a misdemeanor. But he still pleads guilty to the felony. Mm-hmm. Is that okay?
Your Honor, I think it depends partly on the statute that the legislature passes and whether they make it retroactive or prospective. And frankly, I'm not familiar enough with the statute that was passed and at issue in Hoosdale.
Let's assume that they use the language of this statute.
That is used here?
Decision.
Okay. I would suggest that he is still liable for the criminal penalty that was in place on the date of his offense, because it is our position that the word rescind, as used in 35109, is not retroactive, does not void ab initio Mr. Hansen's habitual traffic offender status. And I can give you a number of reasons I believe that it's not, does not void that status ab initio.
Mr. Connell cited to Truesdale versus State, and I noticed that your briefs did not respond to that cite. Are you acquainted with that case?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I am not. I am not.
What? We've got a lot of words floating around, and I'm going to introduce another one, but what does the word rescind mean to you? Or what, I don't mean what does it mean to you. I didn't look it up in the dictionary. What's the definition of rescind?
There are a number of definitions of that have been cited, Your Honor. Thank you. And I would go to the definitions the interpretation of the word rescind as used in the cases that Mr. Connell has cited in his brief. For instance, he cites a couple of Wisconsin cases, Ilges v. Condon, which was a breach of contract case in which the court said that the rescission of a contract is for the purpose of permitting a party injured by a breach of contract to avoid performance of a contract and then having to turn around and sue the breacher for damages. That in a contract situation.
Can you give me some synonyms, please?
I would
You're able to.
For the word rescind as used in this case, one of the synonyms would be release, and that is used in the DOT abstract attached to the motion, the post-conviction motion. It says after the habitual traffic offender order of December 12th, 1996, that it was released on February 3rd, 1999.
What are some of the other common dictionary definitions?
Sure.
Three or four or five, if I were going to
sure.
right now pick up, I would be reading
sure.
what does a rescind mean?
The case that was cited in the state's brief, a case from 1945, indicates in reference to an order of a commission, as is this, it's an order of a state body, that when referring to an order and the rescission of an order, it means to presently nullify, repeal, or I think amend. And it uses the word presently. And the reason the state body, the court used that in terms of the order of a state body in the case that is cited in the state's brief is because an order applies to countless citizens who are affected by that order. And for anyone to understand at a given moment what is going on, the rescission of that order must be present nullification and to go forward.
Let me, if I don't have three or four or five mm-hmm. synonyms, let me tell you there's one that I want to explore. I don't know how valid it is. And that, when I read this case, I thought of the word, the argument is there is a reclassification of status, no longer HTO. And I thought, that sounds like it might be expungement. So I go to some ALR and it says expungement. It's a redefinition of a status, a process of erasing the legal event of conviction or adjudication and thereby restoring his status quo ante. And then in that ALR, it has a cite to a Kansas Court of Appeal case. That sounds very much like our case. And the ALR site deals with other offenses where record has been expunged or erased. So this is what I'm looking mm-hmm. for. And the Kansas case that's cited deals with an appeal from there. They handle them administratively, apparently, rather than mm-hmm. in court. It says, an appeal arising from an administrative proceeding where the court held the Division of Vehicles had initiated administrative action to suspend driving privileges pursuant to the statute, and this is the point now, where by the date of the hearing, the expungement had occurred after the arrest, but before the date of the hearing or adjudication, that the that the Department of Administration of Motor Vehicles could not consider then that, just like Mr. Connell's arguing, this is a case that supports his argument. But that is in defining expungement, where you have then Department of Motor Vehicles saying the underlying conviction is expunged and therefore cannot be considered in a repeater situation. Is expungement a common synonym for a rescission?
I would argue, Your Honor, no, for four reasons. First, one of the cases that Mr. Connell cites, that would be the Barlow case from Minnesota, they made a good point. They said in that case at page 234, quote, "We think if the legislature had intended expungement of license revocation records, it would have said so in no uncertain language." Our legislature knows how to use the word expunge. If it wants to use that word, it will do so. It did not do so in this case, and I can cite you a series of statutes in which our legislature has used the word expunge. Three more reasons. The driving record that is attached to the post-conviction motion of Mr. Hansen shows the HTO revocation order of December 12, 1996, still on his record. It was not expunged from his record. It remains there. It says it was released on February 3, 1999. Second reason. Third reason, there is a legislative drafting memo attached to the state's brief. If the legislature meant expungement, wipe it off the record, ab initio, as Mr. Hansen argues here, then I don't think we would find this statement in the legislative drafting record. And, Your Honors, this is at appendix page number 104 of the state's brief. This statute, I would point out, 351.09, has what I think is termed a sunset provision, a repeal provision. It says, and I'm reading straight from the statute, "This section does not apply on or after January 1st, 2003. And this drafting note says something else about that repeal portion. About right after the head note, it says, I think AND Chapter 343 comments, number one, HTO recalculation. As we've discussed, DMV would prefer to have the recalculation done as people apply for it rather than on an automatic basis. Now, the important part is coming up. We would suggest providing for the recalculation by statute and having the repeal built in for a period of 5 years after the effective date, at which time the statute would be useless. If you don't want to adopt a repeal that far out, so be it. It will just become useless language in the statutes." Your Honor, I would suggest that if this rescission word in 351.09 meant expunge, then the language wouldn't, as the drafting note suggests, become useless 5 years out. If somebody wanted the record wiped clean pursuant to a recalculation, then they would want to do that in 2004, 2005. But what I think this drafting note tells us is the purpose of the rescission is to presently nullify repeal for any ongoing activity that you may have for current and future conduct, but not for the past, not to expunge from the record. The fourth reason I would give is this, and I'm going to ask the court to harmonize two statutes. That would be 351.09 with the statute immediately prior, 351.08. And at the time, 351.09, the new statute, was enacted. 351.08 provided this. I'm reading the last sentence of 351.08. "For the purpose of enforcing this habitual traffic of..." Excuse me, I'll just tell you that the title of 351.08 is "Operation of Motor Vehicle by Habitual Traffic Offender or Repeat Habitual Traffic Offender Prohibited Penalty Enforcement." The last sentence of that statute says this: "For the purpose of enforcing this section, in any case in which the accused is charged with driving a motor vehicle while his or her license, permit, or privilege to drive is suspended or revoked, or is charged with driving without a license, the court, before hearing the charge, shall determine whether the person is a habitual traffic offender or a repeat habitual traffic offender, and therefore barred from operating a motor vehicle on the highways of this state. Now, this statute is presently in force at the time 351.09 has now become law. 351.08 does not say, however, if a recalculation has been obtained after the violation, then the court will inquire into whether there has been an order of rescission. I would like to point to another case that Mr. Connell cited in his brief at this point, because I think it's important. The court cited, Mr. Connell cited the People v. Fulcia case, an Illinois case, and in the concurrence of that case, the justice said, the state did not have to disprove the existence of a rescission between the time of the arrest and the time of trial. And that's one of the bases for the concurrence there, that the avoiding of that revocation order sometime after the offense date did not eliminate the penalty for that revocation order. Here in Wisconsin, and Justice Sykes went to this point earlier, she asked whether the habitual traffic offender provision is an element of the offense, and no, it is not, and I agree with Attorney Connell in that respect. The relevant jury instruction 2620 has three elements for that, the offense of operating after revocation or suspension. First element is defendant operated a motor vehicle on a highway. Second element requires that at the time the defendant operated the motor vehicle, his operating privilege was duly revoked or suspended. And it says a person's operating privilege remains revoked or suspended until it is reinstated. The third element requires that the defendant knew or had cause to believe that his operating privilege has been revoked or suspended. That's it. You operated a motor vehicle, you were revoked, and you either knew or you had cause to believe you were revoked. The state does not have to disprove the recalculation and rescission of the HTO revocation order between the time of the offense charged and the date of trial or conviction. The absurd results that would follow if Mr. Hansen's argument to prevail here would include this. If at any time between the date of violation and the date of conviction, an HTO revoked person could apply and get rescission, what would stop the defendant from applying a day before jury trial, perhaps in the middle of jury deliberations, getting an order of rescission? Would that be the critical moment when the deliberations of the jury would now have to be affected? Would that become a defense in the middle of deliberations because suddenly the court has lost criminal subject matter jurisdiction because DOT came through in the nick of time with that rescission order? That's not the relevant time. The relevant time is the date of the violation.
Sorry to interrupt you. How long... Let me put it this way. You think this issue of whether a defendant can be convicted of operating after revocation as an HTO is one that's going to come up often in the future?
Your Honor, I have some informal statistics that since the, and this can be confirmed by certified records of DMV if the court would wish. But I understand that since this statute was enacted in August 1st, 1998, only about little less than 300 persons have applied and reinstated under this statute. And apparently thousands have sought this. Some people, this is perhaps a testimony to the honest citizens of Wisconsin, some people were not even subject to the statute and nonetheless applied for recalculation. But also, a number of people applied for recalculation, did get rescission, but could not reinstate because so many other reasons. They had fines or forfeitures that they had not yet paid. So a little less than 300 people have actually reinstated under this statute. I think the Orathin case that is cited in the state's brief is so applicable here, and I think it really decides the question because Orathin is not decided solely on the statute at issue there, but on the broader principle that, for instance, if a court has issued an injunction and a person violates that injunction, even if that injunction order is subsequently voided, nonetheless, there is a contemptuous action that has occurred subsequent to the initial imposition of the injunction that can be punished. And the Ortham case states so clearly, and I think this is the only rational way to approach this law, so that courts, drivers, prosecutors, and law enforcement understand what is going on the date of a violation. Ortham states this, quote, it is the duty of all good citizens to await the orderly determination of the issues, although their desires may be balked temporarily and even their rights denied. In order to have any rational understanding of whether a criminal violation has occurred, you have to take that snapshot on the day of the violation, determine the applicable law, have the state indicate in the complaint what the violations are alleged, what the state has to prove, and then the sentence flows from that.
Counsel, we have a question.
Yes.
I'm frankly a little confused, and I hope you will help me. You're talking about the date of violation.
Yes.
Mr. Hansen applied, and I let's just say flat out he was an habitual traffic offender on the date of the violation. But he utilized the statute. He applied for the rescission. If he had spoken up at the time of the no contest plea, what would have been the result then? I'm not quite sure I follow your argument on this.
Your Honor, I think that it doesn't matter whether he had spoken up or not. I think there's actually a double waiver here now that you bring it up. Not only did he plead to these facts and status, but he also withheld that information from the court. I think that's a double waiver. Even without the waiver, though, Your Honor, I think he still is liable for the criminal penalties under the Ortham rule, that you have to take the steps necessary to have a revocation order removed through the legal process before you drive and before you can escape criminal liability.
Well, I sort of implied in my comments to Mr. Connell that Mr. Hansen was a hot dog who was mocking the system. Do I understand you to say he wasn't really a hot dog? He didn't have a right to escape being a habitual traffic offender. Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, had he done it the day, had he gotten that rescission the day before this offense, an hour before this offense, then he would not have been subject to criminal liability. But because on that date he had never taken steps, it was a voidable revocation order, but it wasn't void. And I think that's the rational basis on which we apply Ortham in this case.
Counsel?
Justice Bounce.
Thank you. The Court of Appeals opinion, could we... errors or omissions that you think we should cover with respect to the Court of Appeals opinion?
Your Honor, I think the Court of Appeals was exactly right that this issue was waived. I think criminal subject matter jurisdiction attached because under the cases the state cited, Anaton and Mack, thank you, the complaint charged an offense known to law and the facts were thereafter pled. There was clear waiver here, and there was subject matter jurisdiction in which to apply a penalty. Your Honor, also, there was some questioning earlier about the Andrews decision, and I brought that decision up in my brief, and it's easily distinguished. In Andrews, the question was whether the offense on the date of the violation amounted to a crime that was subject to that penalty enhancer. Did the gentleman, Mr. Andrews, sell cocaine within 1,000 feet of a school? He hadn't, because within the meaning of the definition of the word school in the statute, UW Oshkosh was not a school. On the date of the violation, he did not have the requisite facts and applicable law to amount to an enhanced violation. But here, on the date of the violation, Mr. Hansen clearly had that. I would also point out that in Mr. Hansen's brief, he argues that this is not the kind of person we fear on the roads. If a person looks at his driving record, you can see at the top of the record attached to the complaint, all he had was an instructional permit. Mr. Hansen, on the date of Halloween 1998, had never taken a road test. This person had been out on the road without having passed a road test and gotten a permanent or regular license, and had had so many traffic violations, I think there is a public danger to this type of person on the roads.
Now, you use Oricon extensively in your,
yes,
your brief. But I wonder how applicable Oricon really is, because in Oricon, we weren't dealing with a status offense, were we? In Oricon, as I recall the facts, it was he got charged as operating after revocation, and then subsequently he challenged one of the
sure.
convictions.
Sure.
And it was a conviction. And here, Mr. Hansen is not questioning the fact that he was driving after revocation, the charge, you know, the offense. He's challenging his status, because this is a status offense,
sure.
right? Does that make a difference?
I don't think it makes any difference whatsoever, Your Honor, for this reason, that on the date of the violation, the statute provided that if you drove after revocation, you'd be subject to criminal penalties. He did that. And under this case of State v. Canais that the state cites in its brief, 178 was second, 451, the Court of Appeals said that if you are driving after revocation and the convictions that were the predicate convictions for the revocation order were based on suspensions, not solely for failures to pay fines, then you are liable to criminal penalties. That was precisely what was happening here. So I think Orathan is similar in that Orathan drove after revocation, that subjected him to criminal penalties. So did Mr. Hansen. No difference. I don't think the status has any bearing on the issue, because Canais, or Nice, indicates that you're subject to criminal penalties if you drive after revocation.
Counsel, I want to focus in, as I did earlier, and I went to get a dictionary, and I see in the briefs there are, and I know, cited dictionary definitions. I just thought I would get an impartial one, you know, but apparently you agree with the ones cited by the defendant, so I'll use those. And it seems to me, in looking at the statute, and I focus on the word rescind. Now, the legislature could have said, in recalculating, that the department shall correct the order declaring not to be a habitual traffic offender, or the legislature could, after the correction, declare, you know, henceforth not a habitual traffic offender. Rescind means more than just changing. And that's what that has me, the definitions that you mentioned too was annul and nullify and abrogate. And, you know, I think of in marital law, you know, if there's an annulment, it means it didn't, you know, the status is it didn't exist.
Oh, Your Honor, if I may interrupt for a moment, the case Mr. Connell cites with respect to annulment says that Wisconsin law rejects that legal fiction that a marriage never existed in order to authorize maintenance awards in annulment proceedings. It's a legal fiction and rejected in Wisconsin law. And Mr.
So Connell, nullify, from your definition of nullify, it means nullify henceforth.
Henceforth, Your Honor, and that's the status of the law in Wisconsin based on the case Milwaukee ER and L Company, cited in the state's brief, that when you're speaking about an order of an administrative body, it's a present nullification and going forward, but it doesn't go back. Otherwise, the citizenry doesn't know what law applies, what facts apply. What would the officer who writes that ticket do when he cites Mr. Hansen on Halloween 1998? Is that criminal? Is it civil? Is a criminal complaint about to be filed? Is a preliminary hearing necessary? Everything flows from what is present on that date, and what the defendant does in the middle of trial, for instance, 6 months down the line, or even the next day, it should not matter if there's going to be any rationality to the application of the law.
Let's take a comparable penalty enhancer statute. It was mentioned by your opponent, the habitual criminality penalty enhancer, which depends upon the existence of prior convictions of a certain sort or number, which remain of record and unreversed. And let's say on the date of arrest and charging, the defendant had that status as a habitual criminal because of prior convictions in the requisite type or number. And then in between the time of arrest and charging and the time of plea or trial, one of those or more of those were reversed. Could that defendant be validly convicted as a habitual criminal based upon his status at the time of the arrest and at the time of the crime? Because that status has changed. And that can happen in the middle of a trial. It can happen in the middle of a case as it proceeds through the system.
Right. Your Honor, I can't say for sure what would happen. And what I can say is this. At sentencing, even reversed criminal convictions can be taken into account.
That's a whole different issue. That's in the exercise of sentencing discretion. We're talking about his status at the time he's convicted. Even if he was a habitual criminal at the time he was charged, that's no longer true at the time of sentencing because one of those convictions, which makes the difference, has now been reversed.
In this case, I would repeat that habitual traffic offender order was voidable on the date of his offense, but it was not void, and therefore it impels, it requires that the criminal penalties apply under the NICE case, K-N-E-I-S-S.
But it was voided before he was adjudicated.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. It wasn't voided for purposes for retrospective purpose, but only for purposes of going forward.
Not at sentencing, in this case.
The sentence applied here, whereas Mr. Hansen was exposed to about 18 months jail time and $2,500 plus another $7,500 fine. He got 20 days jail and pursuant to a plea agreement, 20 days jail and $300 fine.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Connell?
Thank you. I started by saying I think this case depends on what the definition of rescind or rescission, and I still think that's the case. And I think the definition that I proposed, that is annul or abrogate, is the correct definition. It's the definition that I learned when I was in law school and we studied contracts or remedies. And as I understood the law, the remedy of rescission put a person in the position as if he had never entered into a contract. And I think that the theory behind our Chapter 767 annulment is the legal theory that a marriage is treated as it never existed. That's what an annulment is, and that distinguishes it from a divorce. And I think that if you use the words abrogate, annul, rescind, the legislature knows the meaning of those words. This legislation was prepared by lawyers, and the materials supplied by the Attorney General show that, and the word rescission is a word of art. And it means, in the cases that I've cited and have just been cited to you by the Attorney General, rescission ordinarily is defined in terms of relieving the parties of the consequences of the event rescinded. And that is the position that Mr. Hansen is in this case. I don't know who prepares your calendars, I certainly prefer the synonyms wipe his slate clean and erase. That's not exactly what happened in this case because it's still on record and we're not asking you to erase the fact that he was a habitual traffic offender for some time. But the legislature has the authority to make decisions make criminal laws like the marijuana case retroactive. And in this case, they selected the words rescission and rescind in passing this law. And I think that it's clear and unambiguous language, that it's consistent with legislative intent if we have to go further than that, because while Jeremy Hansen's traffic record is not admirable. In fact, he's never had a traffic violation. All of his violations have been these sort of status things, not having a license and so forth, and not paying his forfeitures. And those are the persons that the law intended to address when they said you can rescind your habitual traffic offender status. And I think, finally, that if you find ambiguity in the law and you're going to interpret this law, that you ought to use the rule of construction, which favors strict construction, the rule of lenity, which says that penal statutes should be strictly construed, and in cases of doubt, the milder rather than the harsher penalty should apply. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Connell. Thank you, Ms. Potasek. That concludes our argument in 99-3142 CR. And on behalf of the court, I want